listeners. I'm Joni B. Cole, host of Author Can I Ask You? For people like me who love books and the stories behind the books, this show gives me the chance to ask authors about what they write and why they write. Plus, I like to throw in a few odd questions just to get to know each author a little bit better as a person. Let's get started and meet today's guest. Today, I welcome Camille Guthrie, a writer, teacher, and the author of 4 books of poetry, including her latest, Diamonds. As one reviewer puts it, the poems in Diamonds were written by a tiger who survived divorce, single mother to middle age, and sleepless nights worrying about money and what clothes to wear. One who knows it could be worse, but wants her revenge, which is, surprise, the revenge of an angel who possesses such intelligence, knowledge, charm, and wit that these poems pay us in diamonds and bless us all. Camille Guthrie, welcome to Author Can I Ask You? That is the motherlode of a rave review, especially given it came from Mary Rufla, Vermont's former poet laureate.
Yes, it was an incredible gift to get a blurb from Mary, and what she said astonished me.
Well, your book itself, I would argue, is a gift. You know, and Camille, the reviews of this latest acclaimed book of yours, Diamonds, they really tell it like it is, including one reader who notes that you write with piss and vinegar. I just love that. But readers, and this is definitely myself included, I so applaud the fact that these poems also have so much humor. So I thought it'd be fun to start there. I mean, a funny poet. Can you talk about that, the role of humor in your work?
Yes. You know, I think like stand-up comedians, humor often comes out of pain. And it is a strategy to manage the things that we, you know, the things we experience, the things we suffer through. It is a way to understand them. I think the humor in this book, in Diamonds, came from my midlife crisis. I thought previously that a midlife crisis was a cliche, maybe something that only happened to men, you know, and then they buy an appropriate car. You know, I didn't think it would happen to me, but it did. It really did. I had moved to rural Vermont from Brooklyn. And I had 2 little kids, and suddenly I was getting a divorce, and I was living, you know, on 17 acres in the woods, and I didn't know anything about living in the country. I didn't have a full-time job. You know, it was a difficult time, and I always try to manage anything that happens to me with some humor. And my mom always said to me, life is what you make of it, which I found irritating when I was a teenager. But so humor is one of the main poetic strategies in the book.
Well, and of course, it's to me the most effective form of humor, because it's not like you're setting out to try to be funny or make us laugh, but it's very organic to the situations that are addressed in some of these poems. And I think it emphasized also the power of the poems and also somewhat the darkness of the poems. So it's a beautiful contrast to the many layers of the work in this collection. But you didn't go out and buy yourself a car, Camille?
Well, I did buy a used car, a Honda.
That's not a midlife crisis car.
It's a perfect car for Vermont. And in fact, I wrote a poem about it, because, you know, when a poet buys a car, it's not a very practical experience. And the poem is about when I was buying the car, I was thinking about Caravaggio and George O'Keefe and Paradise Lost by John Milton, all sorts of things that maybe I shouldn't have been thinking about when buying a car.
Things poets think about on the car lot. Well, it's, yes. It's proof positive that in the hands of an accomplished writer, material is everywhere, even buying a used car.
Yes.
I'm thinking about the first poem in the collection, Virgil, Hey. And it's you imagining the Roman poet sending you down to the second circle of hell, aka getting ready to drive your young kids to school. I think any parent of young kids can recognize that that sometimes can feel like the second circle of hell. And man, Camille, you had me right from that first poem. What a great start to the collection. But Diamonds has also been described as a feminist midlife scream, a screed, an ode to the challenges of an academic stranded, a divorced mother burdened, a consumerist broke, man, all this is so relatable, and a woman who has simply had enough. Do you think, Camille, that writing this book was cathartic, or did it just get you more wound up?
Oh, that's a great question. It was cathartic because, you know, while the poems might sound like a feminist scream, you know, the poems I wrote over 5 years, so they have been revised many, many times and crafted carefully.
Yes.
And many of them I revised to sound as if they are spontaneous, as if it's someone speaking and thinking and going through emotional changes and making connections. I think of them as dramatic monologues. And I think I learned a lot from female stand-up comedians to give a sense of the spontaneity of emotion and to have the moments of humor in there appear as if they popped out of nowhere. That was my intention. So that was very cathartic because although some of the content of the poems people have described to me as embarrassing or very personal, to me, once I work on the poem and I have the idea, I'm so interested in the form of it, you know, and in the sound devices and the line breaks and all the technical nerdy stuff that poets love. So I forget about the emotional content and the screed of it. It becomes enchanting to me to perfect it in the way that I want to.
Well, you said two things in previous interviews that I listened to. And one was you talked about the revision process, how extensively you revise. And I so appreciated that because writers need to know that even when something appears conversational or as smooth as your poems or that they might be a rant or a screed, there is so much art and revision behind that. And I think that's so important for any listeners who are writers to really understand that even the best poets are going to revise the bejesus out of things sometimes to get that effect. And of course, the whole art is to hide the brushstrokes in the end. Can you tell listeners, what does the title Diamonds refer to? And what I'm really curious about as well is why you chose that as the title for your book.
You know, no one's asked me that. I'm so glad you asked. Well, I chose it because it's such a, it's one of those words like roses that it seems, it's so flattened by cliche. It's almost empty. At the same time, it has this incredible depth and history to it. It has so much romance to it and so much material reality. I wanted a title that could mean so many things. So the first association is, of course, with marriage, right? Like the saying from De Beers, diamonds are forever.
Oh, yeah.
And the poem is about divorce, right?
Right.
At the same time in the poem, my children were little and they were playing games on the phone in which you would have to make the game interesting. You would have to buy these gems, right? Like diamonds in order to make it interesting. And you'd find out you had spent, you know, $200 on these artificial gems. Then there is the material reality of how diamonds are mined, which is full of suffering.
Yeah.
There's that song by Rihanna, Diamonds, which I love. And, you know, stars are like diamonds. I mean, it's just endless. And, or people say your eyes are like diamonds. So I wanted a metaphor that was, as Melville would say, fast and loose. And that's how I wanted the poem to unroll, as if the speaker is making all these connections and shifting tonal registers and shifting moods, right? Thinking through, what am I going to do now that I'm middle-aged and divorced and lonely? What will I do now?
Would you read from Diamonds, any poem of your choosing?
Oh, I would love to. I think I'll read During the Middle Ages.
Okay.
I'm one of those people who don't enjoy reading self-help books. So I turned to several strategies and one of them was to turn to the artists I love and poets I love for self-help. And I also had this trick of thinking whenever I was feeling lonely or I wouldn't feel better, I would think, well, you know, historically I'm in this incredibly privileged moment and you know, I could be living in the Middle Ages, having a midlife crisis, which would be a lot worse for many reasons. So that's the pun that started the idea for this poem. During the Middle Ages, oh God, I am so fat, I cry all the time. A kitten scrubbed with a toothbrush online makes me sob. I'm so heartless, 7 species of bees are now endangered, and I didn't do a thing, didn't even send any money to anybody doing any good. And I can't lose weight, I skipped yoga, I'm so hot all the time, so broke, so pathetic, no wise investments. Should have bought a 7-Eleven on a busy corner when I was 7 or 11. Nobody wants to lick my neck. Nobody wants to hold my hand at the doctor's office. Nobody to grow old with me, I'm so crabby. To pluck my beard, feed the cat I don't have, and read me endless Russian novels at night, all the ones I still haven't got to, so greatly depressing. Where are you, handsome? Are you driving in your car to come visit me, bringing a bottle of wine and a present so gallant? A new translation of Akhmatova? I love it. No? Well, I guess it's better than living in the real Middle Ages when some shithead priest threatens you with hell to pocket your last coin. And there's no Tylenol, so you have to suck on some skullcap seeds. And knights canter about knocking you down to take your maidenhood with pointy lances. And you have to work as a midwife with no birthing tub. Nobody washes their hands or votes. Nobody knows about DNA or PMS or NASA. There's nothing to read, if you can read, except boring doctrines or spiritual exercises by Gertrude the Great. I'm not kidding. Yes, there's Dante, Chaucer, and some sagas, but it's not like you'd get near those books. You'd be lucky to have some jerk recite the latest by Wolfstan the Cantor by campfire right before he beheads your uncles and forces you to rub salve on his abs. You know, you'd be sweating in a wheat field at 22, dying from your 10th pregnancy by the bailiff. Courtly love, not a lot of it, I bet. Some local doctor would have to drill a hole in my head to let the demons out, because I'd be full of black bile plus heresy as I am today. It would be an awfully hard time when the sun revolves around the earth and kings are unbelievably selfish, the Roman Empire fell flat, Vikings disemboweled your cousins, and the lord of the manor thinks you're cute. And it'll be a very long time before pop art and meerkat videos and cotton candy and sexting and fish tacos and girl bands. Everything's just so bad and you have boobos. Hopefully, I'd get shoved into a nunnery to have an ecstatic experience with mystical Jesus. Or better yet, I could be a hardcore samurai laying down justice on the heads of corrupt lords. But that was tough work, dirty work. You're working for nobility who at any period in history are the worst people in the world. And to be an unemployed Ronin had to bite Sunday afternoons, no mom around to make you soup. Even if all the brothel ladies want to scrub your back, sometimes you only want a nice nap and some Neosporin on your wounds. Ah, if only I could be like the divine Seishonagon, resplendent in silks with 7 layered sleeves, writing in my room about politics, gossip, my lovers, listing splendid, awkward, annoying things, things that make one's heart beat faster. I wish. Okay. I could be her devoted servant, tidying her papers and fluffing her pillow. But even she found many hateful things about living in the Middle Ages, like crying babies, messy guests, and mansplainers so irritating, even way back then, you better shut up and take your medicine.
Amen to that. I wish we had the time for you to read it again. It is such a rich poem. Yet another reason, listeners, you have to go out and get this collection, Diamonds. I found that poem stunning. And this poem, During the Middle Ages, it has a theme, a resonance that I noted in Diamonds, the title poem as well, which is your mentality, things could be worse. And you've talked about that in some of the poems. And my understanding is that's a bit of a mindset with you, a habit of your thinking that things could always be worse. Is that attitude really foundational to your perspective? Is it a part of who you are?
Well, I guess so. But, you know, in a kind of reflexive way, I mean, it's a children's book that my mom used to read to us by a man named James Stevenson in 1987. It's a hilariously charming book. And it's something I would talk about with my kids, you know, like an evening when we'd be locked out of the house and we would say, well, it could be worse. When we come home, bears could have moved in, you know, things like that. It's a way also to reflect upon what's joyous and what's good in one's life.
There's so much to think about and allow to sink in during the Middle Ages, the poem you read. I love the thought of a world without fish tacos. But on the other hand, there's mansplaining. So everything gets balanced out, right? Which is worse, the Middle Ages or contemporary times? Why did you choose that poem to read out loud?
I do want to say that Say Shonigan does complain about that in the Pillow book. She wrote that in the 10th century. So it never stops, does it?
That's so funny. I didn't know there was a historical documentation to that phenomenon. Oh, gosh. Well, you know, Camille, your work has graced journals from the Boston Review to Tin House, and that's barely even the surface of the places you've been published. Your work has appeared in two collections of the best American poetry. Do you feel like you're where you want to be as a poet right now?
I would say I am so grateful to the editors who've published my poems and grateful to Boa Editions for publishing Diamonds, which was a life-changing thing for me. And the poem Diamonds went viral twice, and that really changed my life because I felt like suddenly I had readers and I had so many people writing to me about the poem and sharing experiences. So I feel very grateful, very happy for where I am as a writer. And I think that most writers feel like this too, that you're always worrying about the next thing. So I don't know if I feel settled or happy. I think it's just the nature of being a writer or an artist that you just always want to be working on something else and worrying about that project.
I want to switch gears, Camille, because of course, writing is one of your jobs, but you're also the director of the undergraduate writing program at Bennington College in Vermont.
Yes.
And I noticed specifically one of the lines in Diamonds was, I have the greatest job in the world. So if that is true, Camille, I'd love you to tell me what is so great about your job.
Oh, thank you. Well, I love being a professor. I love reading literature and talking about it and working with students and seeing what they think about the books we read and teaching them how to improve their writing. I love teaching grammar. I love every aspect of it. So I feel very lucky to have the job. So several of the poems in Diamonds are about teaching.
Yes.
One is about teaching Paradise Lost and Hamlet comes up, and I teach Judith Butler. And it's just always interesting to come back to a text with students who have read it for the first time. And that is fascinating to me. How when I was read Hamlet, when I was in high school, I related to Hamlet. And then when I went to college and, you know, started studying feminist literature, I related to Ophelia. But now that I'm a mother and middle-aged, I relate to Gertrude. I had not understood her before. So I love how those deep texts can refract themselves when you teach them over and over again.
That's interesting. I love how you bring those texts alive. You so reanimate them in your poetry. It's just astounding. I also particularly appreciate as a teacher myself that you have equal enthusiasm, or at least it sounds like that, from teaching Hamlet, for example, to also helping people with grammar. So,
yes.
You know, and that's the gamut, isn't it? I just think that is just wonderful. So, Camille, you have this meaningful and, I'm assuming, very demanding job, and you've got these kids. And so, of course, you've got a lot of free time on your hands.
Tons.
But seriously, tell me, for myself and for all those other overextended types out there who want to write, how do we do it? How do we fit in, or how do you fit in creative work in a very busy schedule?
Well, it's hard, of course, you know, but in one way, you know, the professor's life is wonderful because we have summers off and breaks that are intended to be devoted to our own work. So that is a wonderful thing. But I do think that no matter what anyone's doing, if you're going to be a writer, you have to have a devoted practice. And that devoted practice can be writing 15 minutes a day, right? And not many writers live off of their books. So it is something you have to be very disciplined about. And also, I think it's crucial to have writing friends and a writing community. I know that in my life, I have a handful of female friends who are also writers, and we hold each other and support each other and encourage each other and listen to each other's disappointments, because rejection is a great part of a writer's life, something you have to get used to. And to have a community is absolutely essential, and a practice to not wait for inspiration to write every weekend, or to, you know, to do whatever is manageable, but never stop that, because you don't have time to wait for inspiration. And writing is a practice. Writing's a social activity. You need to exchange it. And this is what I teach my students as well. Some people seem naturally good writers, but most of us practice and rewrite and revise and get feedback and have to be open to feedback. And you have to, you know, also kind of have a sidekick in your mind who keeps sending out your poems, who believes in you and cheers you on, even if you're disappointed, you know, for the fifth time you've been rejected by the New Yorker.
Yeah, fifth, you're just beginning, right? I have one last question for you, which is, if you were to write a 6-word memoir, what would it be?
This is my answer, and I would like to explain.
Of course.
My memoir would be, I would never write a memoir.
Well, that begs explanations.
Yes, I know. The first answer is that I'm actually quite shy and private, and it's hard for me to be extroverted and to read my poems in public. But on the page, I'm a very different person. I can bring the full force of my emotions and ideas to the page, and I try to be as fearless as I can. But a memoir, you know, depends upon a kind of truth that to me artistically is not compelling. Whereas in Diamonds and in my other poems, I'm very interested in hyperbole, in drama, in apostrophe, which for people who don't know that the poetic definition of that is calling out to someone or something who is not there. So my poems are often dramatic monologues to people who are not there, like my poem, My Boyfriend, John Keats, you know, who's clearly not my boyfriend. He died in 1821 of tuberculosis. Or I have a dating profile written in the OK Cupid style in Hieronymus Bosch's voice.
Right.
Or a poem written in Madame Du Barry's voice. And I love fictionalizing or dramatizing my ideas or feelings or experiences. So when my poems are read as confessional, they're not entirely confessional. There are things in there that have happened to me, but it's performativity that I'm interested in.
Right.
I would rather write a novel than write a memoir.
You know, writers can evolve and change for sure, but to understand what genre fits what you want to do, how you want to speak to readers. And so I love that you're firm in your understanding of that now. And who knows? But well, we're lucky to get your poetry, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Your fearless, fearless poetry. Camille, I want to thank you for your time and for writing poetry that it really did speak to me as someone who is also a bit inundated with work and life and general overwhelm. And yet you made me feel like I'm not alone screaming into the void. So seriously, thank you so much for your brilliant book, Diamonds, and also, of course, for sharing your time with me today.
Thank you, Joni. I'm so touched that you would say that. And that's why I dedicated the book to my girlfriends and all the girlfriends who get it. And you also make me feel like I'm not screaming into the void as well. I'm really grateful you asked me to your podcast, and it's such a pleasure to talk with you.
Listeners, if you would like to learn more about Camille Guthrie, her latest collection, Diamonds, and how things could always be worse, please visit CamilleGuthrie.me. That's CamilleGuthrie.me. So that's it for this episode of Author, Can I Ask You? Thanks, everybody, for listening. And if you like what you heard, please spread the word and visit me on my website, joanievcole.com. In the meantime, take care, act civil, and don't be afraid to ask the odd questions.